Out the Box is brought to you by the South African Jewish Museum. Preserving our past, celebrating the present, and inspiring our future.
Good morning and welcome to Out the Box, for minds that don't fit the mold, but hearts that keep striving. Welcome to our show today, and if you're a parent, I'd like to start by asking you something. Have you ever gone to bed wondering whether you got everything right that day? Or did you perhaps lose your patience, maybe shout when you wished you hadn't? Perhaps you forgot something important, or you found yourself looking at another family, which many of us actually do, and myself included, whether it's at the school gate or on social media, and you keep wondering, how do they seem to have it all together? I think that many parents know that feeling. The reality is that parenting has become incredibly noisy. Everywhere we turn, there's advice, there's books, there's podcasts, there's social media, there's experts, and everyone seems to have an opinion about what we, as parents, should be doing and how we should be raising our children. And somewhere along the way, many parents have thought quietly to themselves and they've asked the question, am I doing enough? Or perhaps even, am I enough? But what if that's the wrong question to be answering? Long before Instagram or Facebook or TikTok, there were two remarkable psychologists who were answering these questions. And I'm talking about the 1950s and the 1960s. It's how do we create perfect parents? But rather, the two psychologists said, what do children actually need from the adults who love them? And I want to welcome our guest today, psychologist Raylene Pockery-Bleeden. She worked in schools for a long time, and now she's in private practice where she treats adults, well, not treats, but sees adults and children, teenagers, families, and guides them along the way. Raylene, welcome. You were the first guest on my ever first episode, so I welcome you back.
Thank you.
And I hope I've improved since. And it's really such a pleasure to have you on.
Lovely to be here. Thank you for having me.
Before we start, I sent out a WhatsApp to a few people that I know, and I asked questions about their mothers. And Craig is going to play this clip for us, and I want you to just give a think of the questions, and if you could answer them, and if you can, WhatsApp your answer to us. Enjoy.
If my mom had a catchphrase, what would it be? She always says, you do what you think is right, which is her way of saying she completely disagrees, but she doesn't want to argue. If my mom had a warning label, what would it say? It would say, warning, we'll reorganize your house and may become stressed if anything is out of place. Complete this sentence. My mom was right about taking a panada. I still think panada is the answer to every problem today. Headache? Panada. Sore throat? Panada. Minor inconvenience, probably a panada too. The day my mom acted like a tiger mom, she's never been a tiger mom. She's just more like an anxious golden retriever who just wants everyone to be okay.
So this clip was sent to me by a brother and sister. They answered it together. And it was so lovely because what he was saying is that you could see this love and security and protection that their mom was giving to them. Even though we did it in a very lighthearted way, it was a beautiful way of saying, Mom, thank you. You saw me. You looked after me. Listen to these two.
If my mom had a catchphrase, it would be something like, I'm a little worried about. If my mom had a warning label, it would be something like, dangerous when stirred.
So this one, I was precipitated in asking this gentleman to send in these two clips because I attended an 80th birthday party, and it was his mom's birthday party. And the speeches that he and his siblings made to his mother were lighthearted, and there were lovely jokes in between. But again, you could hear the love and the protection that their mom was offering them. And as adults, these were adults in their 40s and 50s, and the the respect that they had for their mother was so palpable. This is the last one. Have a listen.
I've been asked to answer some questions about my mom, and I don't think I've got the adequate answers to them. So I'm just going to chat a little bit about my mom. My mom loved to tell myself and my two siblings that she's a cool mom. And that, you know, my mom is a cool mom. And I think growing up was quite an interesting thing, because I grew up in a very sporty home with a lot going on, cricket balls going through windows, and injuries from bee stings to who even knows what. But I think something I learned about my mom is through the adversity that we put her through as children, to her learning disabilities, which I struggled with growing up, my mom has always been a stead force in our household. And she's had the ability to find a level to level with us and to interact with us. Might not have been about sport, might not have been about school, but find ways to ground us while also boosting our self-esteem and making sure that we grew up in a manner in which we would go out into the world and show what it really means to be a kind and caring and generous person, while also believing in yourself and backing your own ability in what you can accomplish. So I look back at it and I do think my mom was a cool mom, and as she'll remind me every day going forward that I did say she was a cool mom. But my mom was more than a cool mom. My mom was a role model for us. And I think myself and both my siblings can speak to that.
So many of you might recognize that voice. And that was one of my own children. And I asked them to send something in. The interesting thing is that only my middle son sent it in. And I wondered to myself, why would that be? And Raylene, the other interesting part about these clips is I asked a variety of people, and it was the men who sent in the answers to those questions. And it struck me, you know, is that a reason because their relationship is different from their relationship with their mothers or daughters and mothers? So before we get into it, we're going to talk about Melanie Klein, who was an Austrian-born psychoanalyst, and the English pediatrician and psychoanalyst, Dr. Donald Winnicott. So, Raylene, these two psychoanalysts who studied or who worked and researched around the same time, is that correct?
Yeah, they were both in the mid-20th century, completely different theories, but yeah, around more or less the same time, yeah.
Okay. And were they dichotomous?
Oh, totally, totally. Both of them had completely different views of how children view the world and children's experience of the world. I mean, there are similarities, but the approach is completely different. So let's start with Winnicott. And Winnicott I found to be a wonderful theorist and a very supportive theory behind what he proposes. So he was a pediatrician as well as a psychoanalyst working in the mid-20th century. And what he, I feel personally, that he freed parents of a huge sense, a huge burden. Let me put it that. He provided a relief because he came up with the idea that one doesn't need to be the perfect mother. One has to be a good enough mother, and hence the saying, the good enough mother, which we're talking about today. That was coined by him. And what he meant by that is he said that the child's experience of the world does not have to be perfect, and the child's experience of the mother does not have to be perfect. The experience needs to be made meaningful for the child, and that will... That is what makes the child well-rounded or, you know, feeling safe and secure. So he's saying that it's not about whether you're perfect or you're not perfect. He's really saying it's whether you are steadfast, are you reliable, are you loving, can you provide for the needs of your child in a almost, you know, or a good way, a good enough way, let's put it like that, and then you can be the consistent caregiver, and that is what the child is needing. So it's a very not punitive way of looking at parenting, which I find very freeing.
Right. And you know, just to put it into my own words, because I'm not the expert here, and many parents listening are experts, so I again say I'm not the expert, and that's why Raylene's here. But is it, in other words, a parent who responds to their child's needs consistently but not perfectly? And is it that ordinary parents living ordinary lives were always giving their children far more than they actually realized?
Absolutely. And that's the beauty, I think, of Winnicott, is that especially today, parents, first of all, I'm no expert, let's just say that.
Well,
I'm just sharing the theory.
I beg to differ.
Okay. Well, we're just sharing a theory which, if implemented, can make a significant difference in both the life of the adult and the life of the child. Because what Winnicott is saying is that if you can, basically he's saying, if you can do your best, and you do your best, which you is in the best interest of the child, and doesn't come as a very high cost to you, then you and your child have what we would call a good relationship or a good working relationship, and so therefore you would be a good enough mother. Why? Because you are not twisting yourself into a pretzel to be...
As we do.
Correct. And your child is not having every single need met, but also not having all their needs met. So I find that Winnicott is like a stabilizing, moderate perspective of what people need and what people can give.
Right. Almost somebody once said to me, benign neglect.
Correct. That's exactly it, you know. And he goes on in the literature to say that you want what he calls optimal
frustration.
He says you want optimal frustration. So he says, doesn't mean that if your child says, Mom, can I have the sucker, you have to say yes. Mm. He's saying you can say, you know what, I'll buy the sucker, but you can only have it after supper. And that is good enough.
Right.
Or you can say, no, this sucker is not necessary. It's almost supper time. You've had lots of other treats today. You don't need it. And that's still okay.
I think a parent is then still holding that they are the parent.
Correct.
And they are going to help you make the right decisions.
Right.
And they'll lead you, you know, this may start when we have babies and toddlers. And one of the conversations I had earlier with somebody at High was that she's a working mom. And when she left her mom, she had to close the garage door because she, you know, the little girl was standing and watching her leave, obviously with the minder. And she felt like there was this actual physical, visual barrier that said, I'm going now, but did she understand I'm coming back? I want you to answer that question as soon as we come back from this quick ad break.
Out the Box is brought to you by the South African Jewish Museum. Preserving our past, celebrating the present, and inspiring our future.
If you've just tuned in, I'm speaking to educational psychologist Raylene Pockrey-Bleeden, and we're investigating and exploring the meaning of the good enough mother. So, Raylene, where we left off, can you speak to that little girl standing in the garage, watching her mom leave for work, and actually the physical view of that garage door closing?
Yes, well, you see, I mean, that is a very difficult experience for the mother and for the child. Definitely heartbreaking can sometimes be for both of them. But what Winnicott is saying is that is how the situation is managed.
Mm.
So, of course, he doesn't speak particularly about this instance, but what we apply is that if the child is left in capable hands, in a warm environment where their needs are going to be taken care of, they've got someone who loves them or likes them or is looking after them, and they feed them, and they're going to change their nappy when it needs to be changed, and they are going to be in a warm, nurturing environment, Then when the mother leaves, of course the wrench is going to be there because it's your child. It's your firstborn, your secondborn, so there's always going to be that wrench. It's always hard to leave the children to go. But the mother can go with a peace of mind that the child is not going to be,
neglected.
That's right. That's A. And that the child is not going to be so severely affected that they'll never be able to have real relationships in life because she wasn't at home for...
I think that's very real because that child, and correct me if I'm wrong, is holding two feelings. They're holding that they love their mom, but they're also holding that, I'm a little angry right now, so I'm gonna cry and perhaps have a bit of a tantrum that you're leaving. And I think that's what parents struggle with so much.
Right. It's the conflicting emotions, yes. You see. And that's why Winnicott is so reassuring, because he's saying it's fine that the child will have the conflicting emotions. Mm. In fact, he says it in a different way, but both him and Melanie Klein, who you mentioned before. So Melanie Klein comes from a much more primitive way of looking at things. And she also talks, you see, both of the focus is on the child's inner world.
Mm.
And that's the important focus here. Mm. So Klein was saying that children are born with a split inside of them, a good and a bad split.
Mm.
And the mother has to make sense. So she has to nourish the good and make sense of the bad split for them. A practical example, when the baby's screaming because they're hungry, they feel, oh my God, I'm dying of hunger here. Someone needs to feed me.
Mm.
So when the child is fed, that bad split is mediated, you see, and that's what she talks about. She talks about making sense of the world for the baby,
right?
So you give the baby the bottle, you say, don't worry, darling, here's your feed, yes. Everything's going to be okay. Then the baby learns that split is not terrible. It's a feeling.
Yes.
It can be, met, and then I can go on.
Right.
And so she brings, but she says that's in constant fight the whole time in the child's world, and that's why there's a lot of pressure on the mother to mediate that. Mm. Winnicott doesn't disagree necessarily, if you have to look at it in the theory, but he disagrees with the approach. You see, he's saying that, yes, these feelings are constant all the time.
Mm.
It's not necessarily such a split. That's real life, actually, if you think about it. There's days where your mom will say, yes, you can have a sucker, and days when she'll say, no, you can't, and you have to deal with it.
Yes.
So it's the good and the bad all the time going on. And you have and what Winnicott is saying, that if you say, no, I'm not giving you the sucker, you're not necessarily the bad parent.
Right. He's talking about environment, things that would happen
Correct.
To a child, within their... excuse me, within their environment.
Correct.
So when we were preparing for this for today's program, and we were sitting together, and I said, it's almost like you have to be Mary Poppins. You have to be perfect in every way. You have to be calm. You have to be patient. You have to be able to sing, and you have to and you have to know what to do in every situation. So do you think many parents are unknowingly measuring themselves against a standard that simply doesn't actually exist?
Absolutely. I think today, especially today, parents are under a huge amount of pressure to be the perfect parent, the encouraging parent, the motivating parent, everything. Everything that your child needs, you need to be, whether you agree
or
you don't.
And you can do no wrong.
And you can't do any wrong, because if you do any wrong, your child will collapse.
Mm. Mm.
And that is perhaps why we have a generation of very sensitive people that don't, there's all this talk about resilience and grit and all that type of thing.
Yes.
And the only way you actually get that is when you are frustrated. And that's what Winnicott's talking about. So he's saying, don't go out your way to frustrate the person, because that's just nasty.
Mm.
But there's what he talks about, that optimal frustration. So he says, so if the child can't have the sucker, it's okay.
Mm.
But you can say, I'm sorry, sweetheart, you can't have the sucker now because it's supper time. Or you can't have it today because you've had a ready one today.
Mm.
So you're making sense of it. And that's what it's all about.
So it's not terrible traumas that make children resilient or terrible experiences. I mean, those do make people resilient.
Yes.
But you can also develop resilience through Winnicott's way of thinking.
Absolutely. Like, terrible pressure to get to the school on time to pick up your kids. Doesn't matter that there's 5 million cars in front of you. Oy vey, my kids are going to be waiting. What you going to do? She's going to think I'm not coming. I'm late. I can't get hold of her, blah, blah, blah. it's okay. It's okay for the kid to know, you know what, there's millions of cars outside. My mom said she's picking me up and she'll be here. I may not be able to see her now. Maybe I'm parked, you know, further down and I can't see her, she can't see me. Maybe she's running late, maybe she's caught in the traffic. Doesn't matter, but the kid knows that the mom is coming to pick her up and she will come. She may be late, she may be stuck in the traffic, but she will be there.
And I can be upset with her, but I still know that she hasn't left me alone.
Exactly. Okay. So it's fine. You can feel cross, you can feel angry.
Yes.
You don't want your mom to be late. You're in a rush to get somewhere, but there's traffic and there's a real world out there, real life.
Yes.
And your mom hasn't been there on time.
So, I mean, you're describing that if children don't need perfect parents, what is it that they do need? And I think what you were saying about showing children that you are actually imperfect, is that part of how Winnicott says we should raise children?
Yes. Well, he doesn't write about showing your imperfections per se, right? But he does say that children don't have to, you know, you hear the expression, you're born with a silver spoon in your mouth. So if you're born with a silver spoon, then, you know, that's great. Everything in life is perfect.
But does that pertain only to wealth?
No, to everything, you know. So you say you've got it, you've got wealth, you've got health, you've got great parents, a lovely car, blah, blah.
You need nothing.
You're wanting for nothing. That's right. Better to say that. It does not mean that you're going to be a healthy person, right?
Right.
Because all that means is whenever you've had a need, whether it's been justified or not, it's been fulfilled. That's not what he's saying.
No.
So he's not saying indulge the child. He's not saying whatever a kid asks for has to be, you know, supplied.
Right.
He's saying this world, well, he's not saying this, I'm saying this, but I'm trying to make sense of him, right, is that he's saying in this world, children will have opportunities and circumstances where their frustration is tested.
Mm.
Mm. And that's okay. He's saying it's fine. Sometimes you will be frustrated, and that's where he gets the saying, the optimal frustration. Sometimes it is in your best interest to know that your mom's going to be 5 minutes late. Right. Hasn't forgotten you.
So in a way, a good enough parent is, excuse me, I don't know where this cough button is. I don't think I have one. Okay, I'm back. Thank you, Craig. A good enough parent is emotionally present, consistently loving,
yes,
willing to learn,
yes,
and able to repair the relationship when things go wrong. So it's not, I think what you're saying is it's not about never making mistakes, but it's about perhaps creating a relationship where the child feels safe, loved, and secure even when mistakes happen.
Correct.
And we as parents are fallible.
Exactly. And the world it doesn't always live up to our expectations. So when you arrive late for your child, you don't have to say, oh, okay, well, you need to, you know, suck it up and I'm late for 5 minutes. You can say, I'm sorry that I'm late. I was running late. I had another appointment or there was a lot of traffic. I'm sorry. I know you wanted me to be on time. I tried. I couldn't do it. I'm here now. Let's move on.
So you've acknowledged that feeling. Correct. And you've admitted that, you know, not that you've done something wrong, but that you were a few minutes late to fetch them, and that's okay.
Right. You've made sense of it for
them. Yes, yes. And I think that's what children really remember, when parents make sense of that and are able to say, I'm sorry, I made a mistake, or this happened, it was out of my control, but I'm sorry that it, you know, that you were feeling.
Exactly. And that's exactly what Klein was saying, like in the example I gave you, when the child is screaming.
Yes.
And they want something to eat, and then you give it to them. So what Klein says, she uses the word metabolize, and I love that word because she's saying you're metabolizing the world and their needs for them. So by giving the bottle, you're taking that terrible, aching fear and empty space, and you're metabolizing it into a warm, safe feeling. Here's your bottle. Here's your feed. I know that you're hungry. I'm going to look after you. I'm going to do it. So you're making sense of that experience for them. But can you see, so they're both talking about the same needs,
yes,
just in different ways.
I think it's difficult also for a new mom. You know, children don't cry for no reason, and it's hard because they can't speak, and you're feeling overwhelmed, and now you've got to meet a need, and you don't know what that need is.
Correct. You've got to figure it out.
Yes, yes. There are days when, you know, certainly when I go to bed and I replay everything that happened during the day, and I think, gosh, this was bad, and that was bad. But you very rarely look at, okay, this was not great, but and I can do better, but I'm not perfect, and it's fine for me to not be perfect. When we come back to Donald Winnicott as well as Melanie Klein, does she ask a different question? Is her question more like, what kind of parent does a child need? Or is the question, what's actually happening inside a young child's mind?
Yeah, so that's how their theories began, right? Klein's theory is written from the position of the baby and what's going on inside the baby. So, and that's why she's talking about the split of the needs of the good versus the bad. That's how she puts it. So definitely taking it from the stance of the baby and what is going through their mind. So when they're screaming for a bottle, that is fear and overwhelm and whatever else the kid is experiencing. And then the mother comes and she metabolizes and makes sense of everything. It's the same as Donald Winnicott says. By saying that it's good enough, because he's saying that it's very hard. Sometimes we get it wrong. Sometimes the baby is crying and it's not a bottle. Maybe he's got a wet nappy. But the only way you're going to find that is through investigation, and it takes a few minutes. The baby will struggle in those few minutes, will feel the discomfort. And so Winnicott is saying that that is actually okay.
Right. And certainly in back in the day, when they were working and researching and coming up with their theories, there was no Instagram, TikTok, or social media. So how does a parent, and I'm going to use your words, metabolize all this information that they are being swamped with? You know, it's very difficult to be able to say, okay, you know, that makes sense, or, oh, gosh, I've missed that and I should be doing that. And all these families look perfect with their long blonde hair and running through the fields, holding hands, you know, similar to the pictures that you see on Facebook these days. And you think, gosh, I'm really doing something wrong.
Exactly. How can they do it and I can't? Yeah. How come they, who are X, Y, and Z, can manage it and I can't manage it? And I think that that is very prevalent today. I think parents are under a huge amount of pressure, to get it right, to be the perfect parent. And there's a lot of demands. The kids are very demanding. And we can see the demands, what we think are the demands being filled on social media, right?
We think they're being met.
We think they're being met. But social media is only giving us that image. But that is what parents are taking as their takeaway. That's what they take away as, look what they're doing.
Yes.
And that's what kids take away. Look what that mother's doing.
Yes, why do they get to go to Thailand or Israel, and I have to stay home?
Yes, exactly.
But they're actually going on winter camp, and they're going to have a nice time.
Right, that doesn't matter. It's the comparison. You see, why can they do it and not me? There's no thought or understanding behind what maybe they've been gifted the holiday. Maybe the family have got a vacation home somewhere, so the cost is not the same.
Right.
They don't make sense of what's going on, you see, and that's why the parent has to say, it's like my children are always, often, I should say, comparing. Everyone does this, and I'll say, okay, everyone, but we are not X, Y, and Z. We are the Bleedens, and this is what the Bleedens do.
Okay, yes, we all get that. And I think that in a lot of ways it's so sad because parents are under a lot of pressure.
Yes, absolutely.
Financial, emotional. They're working, some single moms are working double time to be able to give their children what they need. We were actually having a conversation with a young man yesterday, and he was telling us how incredible his mother was, that she really went out of her way to be able to give him the things he needed. So, for instance, if they were sent away to camp, the mom would volunteer to go and work so that she would be able to contribute in a physical way, and then perhaps get
a reduction
in the cost.
Exactly.
And he was like, that is my mom.
Yes.
She would do anything for me, but in a way she also sacrificed herself.
Well, yes, you see, but the difference is, did she feel that she was sacrificing herself?
Well, I don't think this mom did.
Right. That's the difference. You see, she felt this is what I can give my kids. This is something I can do.
Yes.
I'm good at it. I can contribute to the camp. The camp will compensate me for it. My kids will get the experience. I want to do it.
Right.
And that he appreciates. But if his mom had said, oh, you know, I've got no spare time, but I'll just go to the camp and I'll work myself to the bone, never see the kids, be really bitter that I've had to do this, that's not what Winnicott's talking about.
Yeah. And don't, you know, don't show the child that you are working yourself to the bone, because, you know, in a way, it's a type of resilience that this mom has. And she's doing it to give her children a better experience. Mm.
Exactly. It's like a Boer Marker plan, right?
Yes.
This mother
is
making
that.
A plan to do what she can to say, yes, you want to go to this camp. It's out of our league. But you know what? If I work for them, then it's manageable for us.
So I just want to take us back to Melanie Klein. And I'm thinking about an example that's not necessarily textbook, and I could be wrong. But imagine the three-year-old at breakfast and you've cut the toast into triangles and not into squares. We've all been there. We have all been there. And suddenly your child is screaming, I hate you. You know, and most parents have experienced, as I said, something like this. What would Klein say?
So with you know, respect to Klein, she would say that there is the split, right? There was a lovely piece of toast, okay, which was delicious.
Lovingly made.
I wanted to eat it. And you know what? I can see we need an ad break.
Yes.
I'll
come back
more.
To that. Thank That's you.
It. Out the Box is brought to you by the South African Jewish Museum. Preserving our past, celebrating the present, and inspiring our future.
If you've just tuned in, I'm Simone Herring, and I'm speaking with Raylene Pockroy-Bleeden, a psychologist in private practice, and we're talking about the good enough mother. Raylene, you're going to pick up from where we left off.
Right.
The toast.
That's right. The three-year-old who's got her toast cut in a way she doesn't like it. She has completely fallen into a tantrum. The mother is distraught, doesn't know what to do. So the question was, does the child actually feel so distraught about it? And the answer is yes. The child had a beautiful piece of toast, which was lovingly made for her. She wanted it into triangles. It was cut into squares. For her, this is a major
calamity.
Know, calamity. It's a really a breach of,
breach of trust.
So she, and what she, so what happens is children, you see, when you are a child, and sometimes also as an adult, we often experience overwhelming feelings. When the feeling becomes overwhelming, we cannot deal with it, right? That's what Melanie Klein was talking about. Children have got so many overwhelming feelings inside that they cannot deal with it, and so they split. So A, you become the terrible dragon that cut that toast the wrong way, okay? And you're the hated person because you've destroyed this beautiful piece of toast.
Mm.
And they melting down because they wonder how they're actually going to get over this. Okay,
yeah.
So you can see Klein's perspective, right? But both of the outcomes, both of these theorists agree in that, so obviously you're going to say to the child, look, sorry, I cut it the wrong way. Either I can make you another piece of toast, right? Or we can move away from toast and do something else, but it's not the end of the world. So you are metabolizing that instance for her to make sense of it,
right?
So that it doesn't feel so calamitous. And that's what Winnicott is talking about. He doesn't talk about it in calamity, calamitous jargon. He talks about it in frustration, optimal frustration. This is what happens. Yes, I'm sorry. Your toast came out not the way you wanted it. I'm sorry. Either we can repair it or we can do things differently.
Right. And, you know, we were referring to how the child gets really cross about the toast. But you coming and saying, I'm here with you, you know, I'm acknowledging your feeling that you're overwhelmed by this toast that's now in squares and not triangles. And what are we as parents doing? We're kind of regulating
Correct.
Their
you're
emotions.
Metabolizing.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So what is the constant that comes out of it? That it's okay for the toast. I'm sorry, I made a mistake. It's okay. You see, so Winnicott would say, okay, so it's not a calamity. Okay, let's redo it, another piece of toast, another breakfast, often whatever the case may be. And Klein is saying, what you have to show the child is that it's not the end of the world. This is not the bad part of you overtaking, or the bad part of what you see as mom overtaking, gobbling up your toast or putting it into triangles, yes, in a way that you didn't want it. That it can be done differently and can be managed differently, and you will survive. You see, that's what the both of them are saying.
Yes.
Is that if you can make sense of their internal world, is Klein, and Winnicott is saying your external world as well, right? If you can make sense, be the strong parent to say, I'm sorry, honey, I'll make you another piece of toast. Then you are making sense of the world for them and making them realize that, A, parents are not perfect. B, the world isn't perfect. And you can see it from the toast, right? Sorry, I cut your toast the wrong way. Mistakes happen, but you are showing them that's not the end of the world.
Right.
Things can be rectified.
So how would Mary Poppins, flying in on her umbrella, what would she say?
Yeah, so Mary Poppins is everyone's dream, right? And to some extent, we have Mary Poppins in our lives here. We're very blessed. We've got great support in our house. Most of us have got great support in our houses, which take on a Mary Poppins-like role. But the actual idea of Mary Poppins is faulty, because and that's why it was made as a movie. It wasn't made as a, you know.
Correct. And the irony is that she, you know, she doesn't have her own children. She comes and rescues your children for you because you didn't do such a bad job.
Correct. So that's not what you want. You don't want to have to rescue your children because you're doing such a bad job about it. You want someone to be a support so that you can do the job better, right? So that if you've got six little kids at home, you want a Mary Poppins type figure to be able to say, you know what, let me take this kid for a walk while you feed this one in peace. Or let me bath these two together while I do something else with others. So a Mary Poppins type figure and capability is useful. I'm not saying it should be used as a substitute. I'm saying as an addition, as a help, as we look in our days today, au pairs can make a huge difference. The nannies that we have at home, in our homes, they make grandmothers, you know, fathers, stay-at-home daddies.
You know, it takes a village.
Right, exactly. So it's all these significant people. It's the way that they make sense of the world for the children that provides the sense of stability for the child. Like you're talking about that mom where the garage door came down.
Yes.
So, yes, she can't be doing it herself, but she's got a very good stand-in, hopefully, that is making sense of the world for that little one.
I wonder if the mother is the only one that sees the true devastation in a child. You know, if the child is with the nanny or the father or the grandmother, are they exposed to that incredible meltdown as much as a mother would be?
Well, I think the mother feels the wrench at the same time. So that wrench can't be the same for the others, you see. But what you want from the person who's left with the child is to understand that this child has been wrenched from her mother. That she, if she had first choice, she would want her mother there during the day.
Yes.
But reality is the mother has to go to work.
Yeah.
So how am I going to make this child's world make sense to her in a meaningful way? I'm going to pick her up. I'm going to comfort her, and I'm going to say, okay, darling, mommy's going to be back soon. Let's go play a little bit, then we'll have lunch, and after lunch, mommy will be back.
And as you said, we are blessed to have nannies in our lives, and last week on the show, I was speaking to Judy Levy, and she's bought a franchise where you teach nannies or other caregivers, grandparents, aunts, uncles, whoever they may be, to interact on a level that you possibly would be able to give your child, you know, be able to stimulate them, be able to play with them, that's meaningful.
Right.
So I think that parents who do work shouldn't feel guilty, and parents also who need a break shouldn't feel guilty because you have left them in good hands.
Exactly. Exactly. Right. I mean, if you remember when we were growing up, a lot of times we were told children should be seen and not heard. Right. It's a bit of a different philosophy. I mean, today parents would never utter such a saying, first of all. I mean, their children's often to the opposite extreme, you know, that their children's saying is
overheard.
Yeah. Most important, you know. So things change. And you also have to see that it's not nothing of the extreme is good. You can't hear the child to the extreme, and you can't not hear the child to the extreme. Because if you don't hear the child to the extreme and you don't feed that baby, you get that screaming, terrible terror inside the child.
Yes.
If you overfeed the baby and you don't let them experience it, right, well, then the baby will vomit out there and literally will not take in the soothing.
Right. I'm going to take a short ad break, and then I actually want you to discuss what we are talking about, but in the space of adolescents and teenagers, the older child.
Out the Box is brought to you by the South African Jewish Museum. Preserving our past, celebrating the present, and inspiring our future.
I'm Simone, and you're listening to Out the Box. I'm talking about how children actually do not need perfect parents. Our guest today is Raylene Pockroy-Bleeden, and we were speaking about toddlers and babies, and now we're moving into these feelings in teenagers and adolescents.
Right. So obviously, you know, I think they've two very difficult stages of parenting. The young baby is where the theory comes from, because you can see how difficult it is. And I think that adolescents and teenagers, from personal experience, I think are very difficult years. And I think because the children are, you know, they're young adults, they're transitioning.
Yes.
And they have to deal with a lot. They have to deal with a lot of pressure from school. Today, the pressures that the children have today from school are very different to what I had or you had at school.
Yes.
And the demands are great. And I think I'm setting the context here. It's also social media puts a huge amount of pressure.
I was thinking when we were young, we would maybe compare against the family next door. We wouldn't be comparing ourselves, you know, to the global world out there.
Exactly, exactly. And what others can do and have access to and have done and. Mm. It's never ending. Our period of growing up was much more limited. Mm. We went out into the garden, we saw the neighbors, or we went to the park. It was much smaller, much more contained. Today, the world is your oyster in any way. You want to travel it virtually. You want to talk to somebody. It's limitless. And teenagers' needs generally feel limitless, right?
Well, I feel like when you say the world is their oyster, but I have to say I don't think it's a pearl.
Oh, for sure. For sure. I think on the contrary, it's actually this big lurking monster out there which just wants to suck them up, especially through social media, because they are not street smart enough to know the dangers of it.
And they're also left with this constant feeling that they don't have enough.
Exactly. It's an emptiness, like a deprivation.
Yes.
This person has got a Porsche. Why can't I get a Porsche? This person has got and that's what I hear. I mean, as a parent in our community, often, this one has got Nike Air, blah, blah, blah. Why? I also want a pair.
So when your teenager is angry with you because you're not going to buy that Nike pair and slams their door and the windows rattle, sometimes perhaps even break, how do you optimize that frustration?
Okay, so look, I mean, the frustration is real. The kid, they want those shoes, and you want to get them for them. But not everybody can spend a couple of thousand rand getting that particular pair of shoes. So we can't take away the kid's feelings. They are frustrated. They're frustrated. They do feel that they're hard done by. They feel, you know, that they don't have the same as everybody else, and they're right. But that is their set of circumstances.
Yeah.
For some parents, it's easier to buy 10 pairs of shoes. You know, other parents, even one is a struggle. And so what the optimal, you know, realization of all this would be is if that child could make sense of their own unique situation and be accepting of that. Of course, that's much too much to ask them, that their brains aren't even developed to that extent that they can.
Yeah. I mean, it's even sometimes difficult for adults.
Correct. Correct. So it's fine that they go and they slam their door, not necessarily slam their door, but, you know, what they're saying is that I'm angry, I'm frustrated, I wish I could have that. And so we can acknowledge the feeling. We don't have to acknowledge slamming of the door, right? They could do it in different ways. But what they are expressing is their displeasure with what's going on, that their needs are not being met. But that's also part of life. And that's what they have to work through in order to know, because it may be shoes today. Tomorrow it may be the car.
And isn't it true, I mean, I might be way off base here, but isn't it true that Winnicott was delaying satisfaction, delaying, yeah, you know, that immediate gratification, which our children today, I really do feel they don't know how to delay gratification.
Not at all. And that's exactly what it is. And that's what he was saying. He was saying not delayed, but optimal. So yes, you will get it, but you need to wait for it.
Yes. You know, we were going to go into a million other different things. We were going to speak about the different types of mothers, and we are going to do that, really. And I think that we do need to have, yeah, a second episode on this.
Yeah.
But if you were to leave parents with a thought, perhaps from either both or one of these psychoanalysts, either Klein or Winnicott, what would that little bit of comfort be for the parents out there?
I would say that you're doing enough, that you're good enough. That's all. That you are good enough.
Okay. And I think that we really need to believe that, and perhaps we need that to become a mantra.
Absolutely.
For ourselves. So thank you, Raylene, for joining me on this episode.
Thank you. You
were my lighthouse when we did the first episode. So I thank you for that. We're going to have to end off now, but we will be back and we will be discussing the different types of mothers. I'm going to leave you with a quote that is based on Donald Winnicott's concept of the good enough parent. And it goes like this. The good enough parent is not perfect. They meet their child's needs well enough for healthy development to occur. I leave all the caregivers, the moms, the grandparents, everybody out there, the fathers, a song for Mama, which was sung by Boys to Men, which was quite a long time ago, but that's my era. So I hope you enjoyed the show. I hope you will be with us next week. Take care. Take care of your children. And here is Boys to Men.